Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Christina Dunbar-Hester about Oil Beach, how toxic infrastructure threatens life in the ports of Los Angeles and beyond. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dave.
This is such a brilliant book in lots of different ways, actually. I think we were talking before we started recording, and I mentioned one of the things is that it really sort of gets us to rethink so many of our kind of everyday lives, everyday assumptions. But it's also one of those books, I shouldn't say unusually, but slightly unusually for an academic book, that I think is just really interesting, and it's quite a good read, kind of irrespective of your, you know, disciplinary background, or, you know, whether you're a social scientist or whatever. And I guess the place to kind of start with it is, where did the idea come from? Like, why did you want to start writing about LA's ports?
That's a very good question. Might come as a surprise to anybody who knows earlier work that I've done. But the short answer is a kind of a serendipity, where I had completed a couple of big projects about media and tech activism, and I had also relocated for a new job and was essentially a stranger to Greater LA before I moved there for work. And so both tying up some threads from an earlier project and being in a new place that I found really fascinating but was unfamiliar to me, you know, just kind of turned into a all-consuming, you know, curiosity to learn. And part of what was interesting was the fact that I didn't know anything. Maybe this was naive, but I didn't know anything really about the oil infrastructure and the oil history of LA, or very little. And I don't think that that's just me either. I think it's sort of taken for granted and invisibilized in certain ways even there. Although it's not a surprise to people who live there. The other thing that was something I was trying to square is, from outside the state, California has a reputation for being an environmental leader. But then inside, again, Greater LA and going towards Long Beach, where I reside, there is just this massive, you know, energy, petroleum infrastructure and shipping that, you know, the international port is there, the container ports of LA and Long Beach and energy ports. Anyway, combined, they handle something like 40% of inbound container goods from Asia. And so the whole area has this history of being essentially a sacrifice zone. You know, it's very, very polluted. And that was also kind of shocking. Again, it's not to people who've lived there for their whole lives, but knowing that California enjoys a reputation for environmentalism. So the book began really from, you know, my own curiosity of trying to figure out how this had come to be and why it wasn't, maybe it's an open secret, but it wasn't sort of widely known.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not, and actually you get into this in the book, you know, it's definitely not how LA would choose to sort of advertise itself. You know, it's not the story LA would tell about itself at all, really. And particularly, you know, the negative impacts which run right the way through the book's different kind of case studies and different angles on this part of the world. And that'd be another useful kind of introductory moment, I think, is if you could say a bit about the place. So you've mentioned LA, Long Beach, and, you know, this is all the kind of San Pedro Bay area. And I guess maybe for people in the States, they might be kind of familiar, but, you know, maybe international listeners might not be. Can you just say a bit about, like, where this place is, why it's special, you know, like, for example, the fact it's got oil, which, again, you know, we might not always associate, you know, the kind of LA bit of California with being, you know, basically a bit like one of the Gulf states in a way in terms of its oil and its infrastructure.
Right. Yeah. So, again, it's a sort of place out of place. It's not Hollywood and not a recreational or surfing beach or something. It's this heavily industrialized area about 20 something miles straight south of downtown Los Angeles, in this little bay, so tucked into the coastline, called San Pedro Bay. And it serves LA and Long Beach and then distribution infrastructure that goes inland. But yeah, it's kind of tucked away. And the other thing that is kind of peering through once you learn to look for it is really, really heavy animal life and plant life and marine life. So there's this, you know, juxtaposition of this extremely industrial site, oil extraction, oil refining, oil transshipment moving in and out, and then, you know, container volume, you know, passing through, and, you know, all this trucking and, you know, big ports, big freeways, all this stuff. You know, LA is famous for freeways, but the stereotype is more passenger cars, right? It's not freight movement, but actually a whole bunch of the emissions, greenhouse gas and poisonous stuff is from trucks. But that's all juxtaposed with this area that used to be on the land, a really rich wetlands. And then in the water, there's an 8-island archipelago. So right off the coast, and there's also warmer and cooler ocean waters mixing. And so it's just an incredibly rich area for life forms to either live in or migrate through. And all of that is happening at once. And it's actually kind of, for me anyway, even having written a book about it, almost kind of impossible to hold it all together at once because it's so contradictory in certain ways. And yet it's all there. And yet also, I think if you see the industry, you wouldn't necessarily know about the natural history as well. So I'm trying to sort of surface a natural history of the area that might not be immediately apparent.
I mean, it sets up perfectly the first chapter, which is about, well, it's broadly about local bird life, the damage that's been done to local bird life, but also it takes in things like LA's history, its government, the role of the military, which I was really kind of fascinated by, and crucially as well, the idea of what's been happening in the Bay is essentially a kind of, we'll do all this terrible, you know, kind of destructive infrastructure creation and maintenance, and then we'll sort of worry about the damage later. And even where there's been, you know, kind of efforts to do a bit of sort of restitution maybe, or you know, a bit of kind of post-damage protection, these efforts have been frustrated and kind of, you know, run into all different kinds of problems. And I suppose a way of coalescing question there is basically like, what is the story of the relationship between the oil and the local bird life?
Right. So the other thing that's important about this book is the temporal framing. Oil was identified in the area about a century ago, and the ports were sited there a little bit earlier. They were just intended to be general, you know, cargo. But with the discovery of oil, that discovery in scare quotes, but in that micro area, that really quickly turned the course of how the area was developed. And so the port was built, not, you know, oil was important locally, but there was actually, this is like the richest oil fields in the world were discovered in 1920, 1930 in Southern California. And so it became that the port got developed to service a global market, domestic and global market, because there literally was too much oil to even be used in Southern California. So they started, you know, exporting it abroad and shipping it to other parts of the country. And so that wealth becomes very important in, you know, generating, you know, real estate and other kinds of sort of building LA, literally. And so that's the sort of backstory before my story really starts, although, of course, I have to cover some of that. There's a, you know, a commitment to the, again, kind of hardened infrastructure of oil movement by the 1930s. And the LA market's really important globally. But my story really begins in the maybe 1960s, approximately 1970, with the rise of the modern environmental movement. And so as we know, you know, we see national legislation passed to, you know, require protection for endangered species, you know, monitoring and reporting of environmental conditions. We see the founding of the EPA. And it's also in that period that the shipping volume starts to climb and climb and climb. And that's for a number of reasons, including containerization, including just post-war trade patterns, including deregulation of the transportation sector. But what the book sort of ultimately shows, and, you know, chapter one is about birds, is that the regulations intended to sort of, you know, set space apart or protect, you know, wildlife for the environment or whatever you want to call it, instead of putting really a brake on development, they wind up actually almost being so surrounded by, you know, the industrial and the military and the commercial uses of the space that it's, you know, it's a story of, you know, not only regulatory, but also sort of physical capture, where even mitigation measures or, I don't know what word you used, restoration, reparation, they're all just kind of like enclosed in these, you know, polluting and extractive uses of the space. And so some of that's a story about commerce, some of it's a story about the, you know, western edge of the U.S. continent and empire. But, you know, over the last 50 years is really the story I'm telling. And you can really, at this point, I think, establish that a lot of those environmental regulations, you know, it's not that they've done nothing, but they didn't actually create an impediment. And maybe this was the intent, actually, for California's economy and California's right to pollute to just proceed at pace. And that sort of, you know, from the vantage point of the present, seems like the story of the last 50 years, which I think is, by the way, applicable beyond California, although it's really intense here.
Yeah, I mean, I was taken by, I think you used this term, kind of slow violence that's been inflicted upon not just the local bird life, actually, but, you know, around the area. And that, I think, is one of the things that really does carry over in terms of lessons from what seemed, you know, initially to be, you know, quite an outlier, given the nature of oil there, the size of well, the two ports. You know, California's sort of booming economy and stuff, but actually, you know, there are loads of kind of parallels with other places right across the world. And there's a lot of stuff about natural life, but the book sort of also tries to think about what humans are doing in terms of their consumption patterns. And one of the ways you tell this story is with, I guess, the humble banana. And partially this is part of the comparison between the two ports, or the kind of, what would I call them, you know, the kind of port infrastructures in the area. And am I right in thinking Long Beach is the kind of like poor relation to the port of LA in some ways? But also how even stuff like importing bananas, you know, importing food, has got a kind of oil story to it. And again, to kind of give that, you know, as a question, how is oil intertwined with the story of banana imports?
Yeah, so great question. And I think I'll say for the record, if it's not already obvious, this is not the most usable environmental history or something. First of all, I'm not trained, but second of all, yeah, I mean, it's a very sort of transdisciplinary and placeful account. But also bananas, I wanted to think about sort of life, different forms of life sort of illustrating different things. And I also wound up focusing on charismatic species, partly as a methodological choice, partly because readers already know about them or think they know about them, but I can sort of use that familiarity and kind of trouble it in certain ways. So including bananas alongside life forms that actually, you know, natively live in this place might seem like a weird idea. But at a certain point I was like, am I really going for this? Yeah, I guess I'm writing a whole chapter about bananas. But they also really fit. They really fit the story. This is one of the places that they were brought in by ship for over 100 years. They're either the most or one of the very top agricultural commodities moved over the oceans in the world. They're obviously a hugely, I don't know how obvious this is. They're one of the most, if not the most, like consumed American U.S. fruits. And there's, of course, a lot of, you know, history of the U.S.'s entanglements and meddling and such in South and Central America. So, you know, there's all these different threads, but really it was an important product that came in through the port until it didn't anymore. And the reason it basically stopped was that when the volume of trade, not entirely stopped, but diminished in importance and in volume, was that the volume of other trade got so great that the, you know, ports were, you know, scrambling to bring in all the cargo that was coming, and it was causing traffic jams, some of which we became aware of during the pandemic with kind of supply chain snarls and such in 2020-2021. But this is an older pattern here. And so bananas as a perishable commodity actually started departing the Long Beach and LA ports by about the turn of the 21st century and going instead to smaller ports that weren't as, you know, congested and could, you know, just take them in quickly and, you know, get them onto pallets and warehouses or send them to distribution centers without a risk of them sitting out in the harbor for a few days and starting to spoil. But this is all entirely, and this is another reason, as you mentioned, I felt justified in bringing this story forward in this book. It's all kind of riding on and underwritten by and sodden with oil, because, you know, cheap fuel is, you know, absolutely required to both transport and refrigerate this food, and, you know, transport it refrigerated over long distances and still have it arrive and be, you know, in serviceable condition for eating and be affordable. There's even also, you know, petrochemicals that are used for pesticides and fungicides in the places of origin. And so the sort of entwinement or entanglement with oil and petrochemicals is really, really deep, and, you know, arguably is, you know, largely responsible for this, you know, even seeming like it makes sense to bring this product into this place at this volume for this duration and with toxic effects, you know, really all along the entire supply chain, you know, from growing plantations to transportation to distribution.
I was really taken with charismatic species, and the kind of second half of the book has basically got lots and lots of different charismatic species, but two really, you know, kind of like leading champion charismatic species are otters and whales, and we'll take them separately because you sort of deal with them in separate chapters. I'm interested in with the otters, the story of aquariums. And again, you know, if you just, you'd mentioned this is a slightly kind of unusual environmental history, you know, if you sort of mapped out, I'm going to tell the story of oil in LA, you might not immediately think of aquariums, you know, being important. But they're part of a story about, as you keep coming back to in the book, you know, damage, preservation, and I don't know if this is the right word, but the kind of the license or the sanctioning of bad environmental behavior. So yeah, what's the story of otters and aquariums?
Yeah, so the, again, brief arc before my story even really begins is that this is a sea otter that's found, or its original range was about Oregon to Baja California, so south of the U.S. border, that was mostly all but wiped out by the fur trade in earlier centuries. And in the 20th century, there was a small colony of them in Central California, and conservation efforts began. And then again, they were given a boost with post-1970 regulation and being designated as endangered. But there weren't maybe a couple stray otters living in San Pedro Bay, obviously, because that's where the ports were, and their numbers were so diminished. But around, I guess, the very late 90s, Long Beach had at that point lost its naval yard, was leaning into more commercial shipping, but also had this waterfront area that in past times had been kind of like a Coney Island. And they were thinking about like fixing it up and attracting tourism. And people came up with the idea of putting an aquarium here, which a lot of people kind of laughed at. Long Beach had nothing but a reputation as like an oil town and a Navy town. So it was kind of a stretch to think we're going to put on this environmental face. And yet they did. And otters were designated the kind of ambassador, you know, of the aquarium, full of the, you know, to this day, they're the public relations sort of face of the place. But yeah, there's a sort of irony that they are in their natural range, but living on totally infilled land, you know, in a artificial setting, and it wouldn't be at all realistic for them to return to the coast here. And so what they're doing, actually, they are beyond just being on display. They're participating in otter conservation in cooperation with an aquarium in Central California, the Monterey Bay Aquarium, Central Northern. And so they're part of a conservation story, but it's just this... you know, heavily managed and in certain ways, you know, ironic in ways that I got some mileage out of, you know, playing up for almost dramatic effect, you know, little, I'm agnostic about otters, frankly, but again, I can capitalize on the fact that a lot of people, you know, think they're really cute and whatever. I mean, I think they're weasels who are very, you know, maybe they're smart, but they're, I think they're looking at most things that they're seeming to play with as kind of food.
Weasels of the sea.
Weasels of the sea, exactly. They're wily, sure. But Anyway, but again, sort of viewing them and the conservation efforts, which have been extensive, but as sort of surrounded and suffused with the commitments to shipping and to oil. Because one of the big sort of mandates for trying to conserve the otters was that the tiny little population that was coastal would be vulnerable to a spill. And that could just be kind of an oil spill, that could be the, you know, end of the line for these animals that have been sort of hanging by a thread for a while. And so there's been a lot of effort to bring back their numbers, cite them in different areas. But it's, again, still sort of surrounded by and, you know, without really questioning the sort of naturalized presence of the petroleum industry looming over all of it, which incidentally also pays for a lot of conservation, which is a California, an outgrowth of California law that says the oil industry has to, you know, pay a little tax to you know, clean up spills or rehabilitate injured wildlife. But you can kind of see it as, given that the animals are all really struggling to come back, the ones that were designated endangered, they're not making great strides. It's a sort of, you know, pay to pollute sort of scheme. And it doesn't really sort of unseat the kind of fundamental logics that this is really a space for, you know, industrial and shipping and imperial empire use of the coast.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to come back to that with the final question, actually, about, you know, what do we actually do to disrupt precisely these almost naturalized conditions of production and payments after pollution. But before we do that, this might sound sort of slightly flippant, but given your ambivalence about otters, how do you feel about whales? Like, have you got a little love for whales, at least?
So I'm a kid of the 70s, you know, like, we grew up really being, you know, told we needed to save the whales and that the whales were these mystical creatures. And, you know, that's something, I mean, I don't go into my biography, nor is it particularly, I would say, interesting, nor
they made a full Star Trek film about saving whales. Like, it's, you know, they're embedded in kind of popular imagination as being
exactly,
again, one of these charismatic species.
Exactly.
They don't have the same fate as the otters, which it is partially why I think you devote a distinctive and slightly different chapter to them. But you can see precisely the same logics of, you know, look, they need to be preserved, they need to be supported, but at the same time, one of the points you make is this is maybe, for whales, one of the loudest places in the world.
So the issues, again, are, all I was saying is, I don't think my pop culture suffused childhood full of, you know, save the whales is all unique, right? But it is historically contingent, and situates me of, you know, a certain era. So whales are an interesting one. The Pacific gray whale, Eastern Pacific gray whale, is actually kind of a relatively rare, maybe, I think it might be the only cetacean, don't quote me on this, but I think it's the only cetacean that has ever been taken off the endangered species list, meaning conservation in earlier eras worked. But that's now getting called into question, and it's because of shipping. And so the earlier things that had, you know, plagued whales were hunting. Now it's ship strikes and entanglements and other encounters with fishing gear, a lot of which is, you know, plastic and, you know, very resilient in the ocean, and also, you know, can really tangle up a marine creature pretty well. But yeah, so a lot of, again, over this 50-year arc, like, you see the conservation interventions working in that, you know, populations start to rebound a bit, but a lot of those gains are kind of backsliding now, with, you know, climate changes, you know, marine waters heating, food sources moved, you know, this or that ecological set of relations is starting to kind of fray or mutate with heating. But yeah, for the last, you know, couple of decades at least, with intensifying ship traffic in the area, there's a really strong argument that there's a lot of, you know, disorientation and a lot of lethality, you know, serious injury and lethality for cetaceans in these waters that are being so heavily trafficked by ships also. And I think the scientific understanding of that has been evolving. But, you know, shipping volume has also been increasing.
The other thing going on with, I guess, the kind of case study of whales, but also it runs, you know, and is relevant to the rest of the book, it is the pandemic. So what happened in 2020? Did things get better? Did things get worse?
So 2020 provided this really rare moment where when all the movement of goods and people shut down for a brief moment at the very early, you know, first couple of months when the pandemic was declared. And this wasn't just whales, but that's all I write about here. It gave scientists an opportunity to like hear animal sounds and, you know, the animal auditory environment with a lot of the background noise that is really overpowering. You know, there's this pause in that. And so it, you know, maybe provided a brief moment of perspective of, you know, the din that has been created, which is important, I think, for the sort of life cycles of a number of forms of life, maybe nearly all, I don't even know. But obviously, you know, for whale communication and sociality and echolocation of food and stuff is super important. Yeah, and again, that's such an unusual moment. I guess the other one in the last few decades was the few days after 9/11. A lot of things paused. You know, flights were grounded and, you know, borders were secured and all that. So things stopped moving. Yeah. So without really commenting on too much of that, you know, like, yeah, sorry, go ahead. Go ahead. Yeah, we can edit that part. Go ahead, please.
I guess it gives a clue about what we might do. And we've not really talked about, I guess, the kind of theoretical elements of the book. You know, it's been very much, we sort of concentrated on the case studies and both, you know, the sort of products that have been shipped through oil, the animal and kind of wildlife in the region. But it is worth saying the book has got various theoretical interventions it makes, and maybe, you know, a moment to touch on the theory is to answer or ask the question of what do we do about all this. And I was really struck by this phrase, and I wrote it down somewhere, this idea of, you know, we need trans species supply chain justice and the idea of kind of creaturely sovereignty. And I wonder if you could kind of slightly unpack them as a way of getting to, well, what do we actually do about this problem? Because as you've mentioned, with things like climate change, global heating, particularly the heating of the oceans, this is not going to be sustainable, you know, certainly in sort of 50, 40, 30, 10, possibly even 2 or 3 years. You know, the Port of LA is not going to be a kind of a sustainable proposition.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you. So the way I theorize the management of the coastline, the management of the ports, the management of distribution and logistics is by calling that infrastructural vitalism. And I'm arguing that that's kind of a logic that has structured regional managers' belief in what the space needs to be for a long time, or for, you know, earlier than the conservation and environmental measures that we've been talking about, that there's a sort of belief in, you know, national lifeblood, basically, and sort of sustaining the nation needs to happen through trade. And so keeping these infrastructures running, humming, and even expanding has been just a kind of inexorable logic and stated and also like so powerful you don't even need to state it, you know, logic that's been structuring decisions about how to run this place. And it's worth noting that California's economy, you know, if it weren't in the US, it would be just by itself, I think, either the fourth or the fifth biggest economy in the world. And so, you know, by keeping all of this infrastructure flowing, you know, these managers are contributing to a sense of economic vitality. But I think it's actually, I mean, I'm sort of playing with this, but there's almost a sort of animistic belief in the life of trade here that I think is actually, I don't want to say it is actually alive, but it's doing something. And so then the argument that I'm making is that, you know, over the last 50 years with the introduction of these conservation and environmental strictures, they don't unseat that. They wind up actually kind of sitting within it, sitting within this infrastructural vitalism and this life force that officials are imputing to the infrastructure. And that has, you know, implications, and it's deadly and violent and, you know, harmful, even when it's not deadly, it's slowly deadly, I don't know, to life forms, you know, human, wildlife, and other in the area and even outside of it. And so, yeah, how I sort of suggest that we might sort of think against that is by proposing what I call trans-species supply chain justice, which I realize is a mouthful and unlikely to, you know, be a winning slogan for, you know, for change. But what I think is valuable about it, or I hope is valuable about it, is it allows us to kind of hold certain concerns that are often understood to be related but still sort of siloed, which might be, you know, environment on the one hand, you know, labor politics on another, and, you know, imbrication and entanglement between, you know, human-made systems and infrastructures and, you know, the other participants in it. And so, you know, again, whether or not this is successful, I like to think of it as a sort of, you know, a generative idea for thinking about, you know, ecology and labor and power, you know, sort of all along supply chains. Of course, by the time things are transiting through the ports here, they have a history and a, you know, backstory, and then they, of course, move forward into consumption. But this, I hope, allows us to kind of think about, you know, holding together things that, you know, both concerns and sort of material relations that get kind of severed from one another in the process of, you know, production, distribution, and consumption. And so, you know, it's my way of trying to sort of hold those things together, because something the port does very successfully is break them apart. And, you know, in using this site that has all these, you know, almost, you know, too toxic but also too biodiverse or something to be believed, things going on at once, it's a way to kind of hold this all together, along with, again, sort of goods and, you know, provisioning for life.
You mentioned this generative idea. I think that's a really good way of putting the possibilities of the book in context, both in terms of, you know, as you've mentioned, this sense of possibly using it, you know, for campaigning, possibly using it for the kind of analysis of putting back together the infrastructure and the ecosystem and saying we need to do things differently. And it strikes me that there's probably another book, possibly another three or four books on the back of this for, you know, maybe not different places, because you mentioned at the start, you know, your sort of relationship with the place and because you're based there. But certainly, you know, sort of future case studies, thinking through the kind of practical implications of the generative idea. And is that something you're thinking about doing, or was this, you know, you mentioned again at the start your previous work on, you know, broadly speaking, kind of communications infrastructure stuff. So are you going to go kind of back to that, or have you got a sort of completely brand new idea for future research?
Oh, I love this question. I don't have any brand new idea for future research because I remained, I don't know, transfixed by this place. And I also think my work is maybe better when it's placeful or in placed. And yeah, this is where I'm, you know, working and living for now. But I do think it took me a while to actually figure out how older work did have something to do with this, but I think it does. It's still kind of like mediating structures and infrastructures kind of, you know, a broad public concern, even if this is more, you know, environmental and energy governance. There's some tie-ins. But yeah, where this project was relatively tightly bounded around this interplay between, you know, this time period of recent history and the, you know, shipping and energy infrastructure and these charismatic species. And so it wound up, it could have been a bigger book already, but for a variety of reasons, I wanted to write it a bit shorter and sweeter, and hopefully it would have a wider audience than some academic books, including some of my own. So I still have a lot of threads from this project overall that didn't make it into this book that I'm interested in. And so I have some recent historical or past century historical things I'm still working on. I don't want to say there's going to be a sequel because I'm not there yet. I'm still kind of, you know, exhausted and gathering my thoughts. But I am really interested in governance of this site. And there's so much running through it, you know, from community activism and, you know, resistance to the air pollution there, which is terrible. And there has been a lot of environmental justice activism and some movement, but not that much. And, you know, it's easy to be somewhat cynical. Again, California has a Democratic supermajority and is not, you know, Texas or something in terms of its stated affinity towards oil, but the reality on the ground is pretty bad. Some of the things I'm interested in are sort of, you know, local LA governance of the site, LA, Long Beach, Southern California, like air quality. Others include things like shipping regulations and even multilateral agreements between ports to sort of clean up shipping. Also interested in claims to make this place quote greener, but also, I don't know, there's some what's called like blue economy, kind of capitalism in the oceans stuff developing in this area around, you know, aquaculture and kelp as biofuel or kinds of things. I haven't decided the totality of what I'm looking at, nor how it might all fit together in a future project, but I think it's possible there could be something like a sequel carrying some of this stuff forward, you know, if this is the last 50 years, something that might be about threads of governance and scales of governance running through it. I think it's a really interesting time in terms of confronting oil and fossil fuel, series of, you know, really interesting and really hard questions about what it would even mean to transition away from extracting and consuming and exporting, you know, refining and exporting fossil fuel here, which has yet to be written. And, you know, I find myself in a sort of puzzling moment with, you know, the predicted demise of fossil fuel. But on the other hand, what we actually know is, you know, lots of companies are rushing to expand and extraction sites, and, you know, the value of oil is up right now. And it's been, even with like the war in Ukraine, it's just been a pretty wild last 18 months or something in energy. So I'm maybe now babbling, but what attracted me to this site initially and what I'm still interested in is how you would even sort of bring it under control so that it would be less lethal. And, but the, you know, levers and mechanisms and sort of scales of intervention are, because some of them are pretty highly local, some of them are municipal and state, and some of them are much bigger global currents. And, you know, one of the arguments in the book is, even though U.S. and regional managers are ostensibly making decisions about what goes on here, there are also, you know, really big currents of global capital and energy regimes that aren't, you know, other people or other systems are kind of naming the tune and then they're dancing to it. And so, yeah, continuing to sort of think about governing the site and problems of scale is captivating me for a while. But whether or not it'll still be about, you know, cute sea lions, I don't know.